Welcome to Conversations in World History. Before I introduce my guests, I just want to let you know that my first picture book, Big Bad Wolf's Yom Kippur, will be out on August 22nd. I'm very excited about it. It's been years in the works. An incredible process working with Apples and Honey Press and the talented illustrator who does a beautiful job, Martin Moron. It is a fun, humorous book about Yom Kippur, which is not an easy task to make Yom Kippur fun. So I'm really excited about it. Do some readings in Westchester and the city at synagogues, bookshops, etc. The books will be available all over. So if you have young people in your lives, you may want to check it out. And great gift, etc. So as I mentioned, New York City. My guest today, Professor David Trajansky, is a native of New York and a professor of Brooklyn College, a professor of history since 2005 there. He was the chair of the department back when I did my master's degree in history at Brooklyn College. And you may remember I interviewed Christopher Ebert, who was my thesis advisor, and we talked about his upcoming book about Salvador da Bahia that he's doing with Thiago Kraus. David Trajansky is a specialist in 18th and 19th century French history. He's my go-to French Revolution guy whenever I have a question about the French Revolution, which is a topic, as I mentioned in the interview, I love to teach. He Zoomed with my class a few years ago. He's a lot of fun to talk to. And he has also become a specialist in the history of aging, which is a really unique topic, and is publishing a book, which is coming out, I think he mentions in September, called Entitlement and Complaint, which is about the history of aging in the 19th century France. So I hope you enjoy. The French Revolution is always fun to talk about, learn about, think about, and even though I've done so much with it over my career, I came out with some new ideas just from this conversation. So here's David. David, thank you so much for joining me.
Happy to be here.
Okay, I think this is my first David and David podcast, so people might get confusing. Yeah. A little confused, but you'll say all the brilliant stuff about the French Revolution, and I'll ask the questions, and that's how people will keep us straight. So we know each other because you are a professor of history at Brooklyn College, right?
Right.
And that's where I did my master's degree, and I never actually got a chance to take a course with you, but I think we ran into each other when you were maybe walking a dog and I was walking my kids on the streets of Midwood. I don't know if you remember that.
Something or other. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And I think possibly when I was there, you were chair of the department as well, I believe.
Right. Okay, thankfully, so I no longer am. Yeah.
Nobody seems to want to keep that position in any university setting for too long.
8 years was enough.
Yeah, that's a while. And I'm correct, right, that your area of kind of focus and expertise is the French Revolution and that era of European history?
Well, I think of myself as a specialist in 18th and 19th century France, and therefore the revolution looms pretty large.
Sure.
The other area I work on a lot is the history of aging and the aged, reaching well beyond France. But I've been teaching the French Revolution a long time, and I've been trying to figure it out ever since I was an undergraduate in the 1970s in a class on the French Revolution.
Well, my absolute favorite thing to teach these days is the French Revolution. And each year my students say their favorite thing we do in the class is the French Revolution. So hopefully between the two of us, we'll convince people who are listening that the French Revolution is still worth a lot of attention. My students love it because I do a huge role play from the tennis court oath up until the Reign of Terror, where they take on characters and they try to experience it as much as possible. So it's a really memorable part of my course. So I'm excited to talk to you about it. All right, let's start that with, when we are talking about the French Revolution, what exactly are we talking about? What does that mean? Okay. Is that a simple question?
Well, it's a simple question with a complicated answer. And I'm going to refer to a line by someone who was a mentor of mine in France, a specialist in the history of the French Revolution, and that was Michel Vauvel. And he used to begin his course on the French Revolution, this is an undergraduate course at the Sorbonne, by saying, the French Revolution poses the question, can you change the world in a short time? I've borrowed that. I've cited him when I've begun my classes, because I think at the most general level, that's what it's about. And then you can ask questions about, well, what element of the world do you want to change? How do you want to change it? And what are the consequences of doing that? Another thing I say very quickly to students is that it's the French Revolution that creates revolutionaries. And in revolutions that follow, we can talk about revolutionaries creating revolutions. So there's something really complicated about the events, but it's not as if you had large numbers of people saying, hey, let's make a revolution. It was this complicated series of events that you know about in your teaching. And people discovered that they were revolutionaries. And in some cases, they discovered either they were counter-revolutionaries or they were accused of being counter-revolutionaries. So it's a process.
So I want to just make sure I get what you're saying there, because I think I do. And especially when you compare to so many other revolutions, they Iranian, Cuban, Russian, they all seem to follow that path where it's not clear it's a revolution at the start. There are many different groups and people with many different goals. It's the revolution gets more radical over time. Is that what you're saying there?
Well, what I'm saying is that in subsequent revolutions, it's possible to have people who identify as revolutionaries, who make it their life's work to make a revolution. Mm. But that's not the case in the French Revolution.
Okay.
It developed and people didn't quite see it coming. At least the vast majority of people didn't see it coming. And nobody knew exactly where it was going to head. And you yourself mentioned a kind of revolution that maybe goes further than anybody had in mind, mm-hmm. and that is difficult to control. And so there's an important question about whether we are at the start of a process. Are we in 1789? Or are we a few years later, where we can say, yeah, you're living in a revolution, and what are you going to do about that?
Well, let's talk about time period a little bit. Where do historians mostly consider the start of the revolution and the end of the revolution? What's the periodization?
The traditional way is to say it's 1789 to 1799. And symbolically, you could say the storming of the Bastille on July 14th, 1789 is the start. But that's a little simplistic. There are efforts to, by the monarchy, to reform itself. And without that, it's hard to see a revolution occurring. And so you could push it back to, let's say, 1787. You could push it back, if you want to encompass the Atlantic world, to the American Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of ways of doing that. But 1789 is convenient.
Sure.
Because it really moves things along much more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And you end up with the regime collapsing. And
this is Louis the 16th and Marie Antoinette, right?
And so in terms of the end of the revolution, 1799 is convenient because that's when Napoleon overthrows the Republic, and we end up in dictatorship. So that's a convenient end, but there are also other ways of talking about the end of the revolution. There's the famous, perhaps apocryphal line from Zhou Enlai in China, asked what he thinks about the French Revolution. He says it's too early to tell. And that's, of course, in the 20th century.
Right.
So is it something that starts a worldwide process? There's the problem of whether we should be just talking about France or whether we should be talking about a much wider world. And depending upon the geography of revolution, that may determine how we talk about chronology as well.
Mm-hmm. Right. If you're including Haiti, if you're
seeing a kind of Atlantic revolution with the French Revolution at the center, well, maybe we're including the American Revolution. Maybe we're including the Haitian Revolution. And there are good reasons for doing that. And then there are some other revolutions that are less well known that are occurring in the late 18th, early 19th centuries. But the French Revolution seems to provide a kind of model or a kind of standard against which revolutionaries measure themselves and against which historians have measured other revolutions,
right. And I remember hearing that, and perhaps we even talked about this because I didn't mention at the beginning, but you spoke to my class a couple of years ago. You Zoomed in back when we were doing a lot of Zooms in classes. And I can't remember whether it was you who mentioned this, but I think you might have, that the Russian revolutionaries themselves kind of modeled themselves on French revolutionaries. They debated Lenin and whoever, who was Robespierre, whoever else they may have compared themselves to.
Yeah, there's an idea that some historians have played with of a revolutionary script.
Mm.
Somehow, once you have the French Revolution, I mean, there are some earlier revolutions, but the French Revolution is key. But you can have this script about how you make a revolution. And the Russian revolutionaries were very, very conscious of that. And there are other revolutionaries around the world well into the 20th century who are also looking back at it.
Mm-hmm.
And then historians are also making these comparisons and saying, okay, as you put it, is there a Robespierre in some other time in some other place? Is there a Napoleon in some other time, some other place? So historians tend to like to focus on individual cases.
Right.
But we also can't avoid making comparisons.
Mm-hmm.
And so the French Revolution is important within French history itself. And we could say that, you know, the slogan liberty, equality, fraternity somehow tells us what it's about. It's an important moment in the development of the French state. But it is also seen globally as an important moment in terms of those ideas of liberty and equality and of human rights.
Yeah. Well, and I have a bunch of questions that relates to that about its importance, and I want to come back to that in a second. But just to close off talking about the periodization, do any historians bring it beyond 1799 and into the 19th century? Because there's a whole bunch of back and forth between conservatives and liberals and radicals going up into Les Miserables, the play, which is set into the 1830s. So is there an argument there that it goes much beyond 1799?
Absolutely. And there are historians who've written histories on the revolution. Let's say I might get the dates right. I might get them wrong. You know, 1770 to 1870, right? Mm-hmm. Think of it as a century. And certainly, if we want to talk about revolutionary legacies, we see it every generation there's a revolution in France across the 19th century. And so there is an element of either continuing that revolutionary process or reliving it.
Mm.
And so you're absolutely right. And I think there's a there's even a tendency right now for historians to focus on people who lived through the revolution, who survived the revolution, and then thought about their own place in history, their own place as political actors. And I've been doing this a little bit myself in a project we need not get into, but it is part of a broader tendency of seeing how the revolution over decades has an impact on people's lives, whether we're talking about well-known people or whether we're talking about so-called ordinary people.
Right, right. So what are some of the major short-term and long-term successes of the revolution? Actually, before we get to that, let me ask, going back to something we were talking about previously, at what point do people in France living at the time start to believe they're living through a revolution? So we have this wider period of the revolution, but at what point do we say, I don't think at the Bastille, as you were, which is the start, I don't think people at that point were saying this is a revolution widespread. So at what point does it actually become a revolution?
Well, it's pretty quick considering the sort of technological context and the news context.
Right.
There's an important literature on newspapers in the period. There's this great proliferation of newspapers. So word spreads pretty quickly. In terms of the storming of the Bastille, it's a matter of days and weeks, and it may not be noticed by everybody, but the image of the storming of the Bastille spreads pretty rapidly, and there are a lot of different versions of that image. So you've got a kind of print literature, and there are ways in which people learn something has happened. I think when you look at newspapers published all over the country, there's this thing called news that people hadn't really conceptualized before. And so they recognized that it mattered. With the spread of elections, and there are lots of elections during the revolutionary period involving people who knew nothing about such things. So this is an element of the political culture that's evolving. And so people become aware of this. And then there are even, you know, jobs, and there are bureaucratic developments, and people become aware of this. There's a system of revolutionary festivals that take right. the place of traditional holidays. So today we're used to news spreading instantly.
Mm-hmm.
It's not quite that, but it was amazingly fast compared to previous centuries.
Right. But did they, at the point of the Bastille, were they talking about revolution, or was that kind of an isolated event of protest? So at what point are they saying, we are, as you were talking about, we are revolutionaries, we are changing the system?
It's in retrospect that it looks like, oh, that's an important event. There's a sort of awareness that something was important without completely understanding what it was.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another change that occurs, of course, in 1792, which is the overthrow of the monarchy.
Right.
So the story of the Bastille doesn't mean the end of the monarchy. It means a weakening of the monarchy. It means a need to rethink the role of the king.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly the shift from monarchy, even constitutional monarchy in the right. early years of the revolution, to republic, that's something that's hard to ignore.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that people are aware of. And there are images of the republic. There's the proliferation of revolutionary laws. There is a series of constitutions. So it doesn't take terribly long for people to recognize they're living in interesting times.
Right.
History, in a sense, is speeding up. And in a way, you could say that people are becoming aware that they actually make history.
Mm.
Again, it's not something that happens overnight.
Right.
I mean, in the general scheme of things, it's pretty quick considering we're in the late 18th century.
Yeah. So let's go back to this successes question. I mean, you pointed out that it overthrew the monarchy, it instituted the republic. What are some of the other short-term successes the revolution had? And what are some of the, as you pointed out, so then it goes back to Napoleon, it goes back to a dictatorship. Eventually, they're going to reinstitute a monarchy. So what are the long-term successes of it?
I think at the most general level, the long-term successes have to do with the idea of human rights, the idea of a constitutional republic. Again, this can get overturned, but maybe that's also a lesson for us looking back, that even though you seem to have institutionalized change, and even though you have a constitutional republic, you might lose it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think when you look at particular things like the weakening and overthrow of the monarchy, that's a big deal. The idea that you have voting rights and political rights for men, but also some debate going on about what are the rights of women, and debates going on about what are the rights of people of color. Slavery in the French colonies is outlawed in 94. Of course, there's this complicated relationship between the French Revolution and the Haitian Revolution.
Yeah.
And as you know, when Napoleon comes back, he also reinstitutionalizes slavery. So it has to be outlawed again in 1848. So there is a kind of back and forth. But even when things are undone, there's a kind of memory of what was accomplished that continues to play a role. I mean, take something like marriage.
Mm-hmm.
There's a law about marriage in September of 1792. It secularizes marriage. It makes it a contract that is entered into and can be broken. It allows for divorce. It certainly increases the rights of women. But it will be reversed in the Napoleonic period. And you have to wait till the 1880s. And in some ways, you have to wait till the mid-20th century to go back to that very liberal divorce law in 1792. So there's something that happens that's that really represents a change. And even if, to some extent, it's going to be undone or overturned, there's no going back to what existed before. Even the restored monarchy can't behave like the old regime monarchy. If it tries to, it's going to get overthrown again, as it is in 1830. And so there are ways in which we can talk about success and failure in a short run, a middle run, a long term, and you might come up with different answers. I think the sort of most general thing people talk about these days, I suppose, aside from the history of human rights, is the idea of an invention of modern politics. And even though there's lots of turmoil and there's going to be lots of back and forth, it's an important moment in the development of liberal democracy, or the development of a process across the 19th and 20th centuries of democratization.
Yeah. And what's striking to me about what you're saying there is we can talk about successes in terms of policies, in terms of concrete changes, but there's also a power to the symbolism, to the change and what that does to society at deeper roots, to the memory that it creates. I really love all of that. And if we're talking about winners, kind of winners and losers of the revolution, obviously the monarchy was a loser of the revolution. I was interested in hearing a little bit more about women, because well, the black people and slaves of Haiti and Saint-Domingue at the time were certainly ended up, I think, winners of the revolution. But women have a more complicated place. You mentioned debates and some gains from a marriage law. Why was the marriage law a gain for women? And what else was going on with women in terms of the revolution?
Well, the marriage law allowed women to initiate divorce proceedings. Remember, France had been a Catholic country. And one thing we've been ignoring, but that's really important, is the element of religion and the attack on the church that occurs, the sort of de-Christianization is a term that people use to talk about what's going on in French culture. But it allowed women to initiate these proceedings. It allowed couples to normalize what was already a kind of separation, and it allowed them to look at matters of property and individual rights. There is a debate about whether women have political rights, and you can find people giving speeches in the revolution favoring such a thing. That doesn't happen, though there are some women who play political roles. There's a famous woman you know of, Olympe de Gouges, who writes a Declaration of the Rights of Woman and Citizeness that's modeled on the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen. And she ends that with a model marriage contract, seeing the family as a central institution that also needs to undergo change. But there are historians. So let me say there's a debate about the impact on women. In a sense, the emancipatory nature of the revolution means that we've got this step towards equality, towards freedom. But women don't get political rights.
Right.
They don't get the vote in France until the mid-20th century. But there are women activists in the revolution. And so it's a complicated story. There are historians who argue that in some ways the revolution is a setback for women.
Oh.
Because there used to be all kinds of inequalities in old regime society.
Mm.
And now somehow you've got equality, but equality of men.
Yeah.
It's the fact that they're men, right?
That's that really makes interesting. Them
equal. And it leaves open the question of what is the status of women? And so you can read different historians on this gender question and find a variety of answers. And it also depends, again, on where you're writing from in terms of the chronology.
Yeah.
I mentioned a moment ago that this religious question, there's some really interesting cases where the radical revolutionaries close down churches, or they secularize right. churches, they turn them into temples of reason.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some places where women insist on their being reopened. Now, think about the sort of complication here. They're using a political voice that they didn't know they had to talk about opening an institution that's been labeled counter-revolutionary.
Yeah.
So they're acting in the spirit of 1789 in a way, but they're trying to undo the radical period of 93-94 as you go along in the decade of the 1790s. So there are ways in which even women who are going to be defined by revolutionary men as counter-revolutionary, they're actually acting out of some changes that have occurred because of the revolution. That's how
Yeah. if I could think of one word to describe that, it's complexity. And I think that's what my students really enjoy about it, is just seeing about the topic and the event, is seeing the incredible richness and complexity of the different players and the different motivations and how things start, how things turned out. Now, you were just on sabbatical where you were traveling and teaching across the world. Were you giving lectures, I think in Europe and the Middle East? Were you doing it more on the French Revolution or the other topic, which you said you're working a lot on, which is the history of aging?
It was mostly the history of aging, but in some of those talks, I managed to work in the French Revolution. I managed to mention the French Revolutionary Festival of Old Age, which was one of these secular festivals created in the Revolution. Most notably in the period of the Directory of 1795 to 99, but some of them are earlier. So some of the festivals commemorate revolutionary events. So an anniversary of the storming of the Bastille, a festival of federation. But there are festivals of youth and marriage, of old age, ways of trying to celebrate these different steps in the human life course. And I was also interested in the way in which the revolution puts an end to certain kinds of royal pensions, but the way the revolutionary state develops, there are also ways in which people begin making careers in these government ministries. And along with the notion of career is the notion of retirement. And I've got a book coming out on that. Yeah, those talks were mostly on the theme of old age, but I also have a hard time getting away from what happens, particularly in France, and the role that revolution plays.
So your next book is on the history of retirement?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Does it have a title?
Yeah, the titlement, it's called Entitlement and Complaint. Ending careers and reviewing lives in post-revolutionary France.
Okay.
It should be out in September.
Oh, great. Congratulations. Entitlement and Complaint. And while we're talking about books, and David, I think we could talk forever about the French Revolution, but one of the things I love to do is try to keep these conversations on the shorter side of the podcast universe. But I know this is a hard question with the topic as big as the French Revolution, but do you have a couple of introductory popular books that someone who outside the academic world would pick up to learn about something involving the French Revolution or France during the 18th, 19th centuries?
Sure. So let me mention two one-volume histories of the French Revolution that are geared towards general readers.
Mm-hmm.
So one is a book by Peter McPhee.
Okay.
Called Liberty or Death.
Yes.
And that was published by Yale University Press in 2016.
Okay.
And McPhee is an Australian historian of the French Revolution and of modern France. He's written great stuff on 19th century France, and he's written a really good biography of Robespierre. But that's his effort at a survey for general readers. And another is a book by Jeremy Popkin called A New World Begins. And that came out with Basic Books in 2019. It's also an attempt to explain how the French Revolution is at the sort of origin of modern politics and more. And it's geared towards a general readership. So I'd recommend either one for somebody who wants a survey of the French Revolution. For somebody who wants something on the Atlantic revolutions, there's a book by Janet Pulaski called Revolutions Without Borders.
Mm.
And that's with Yale in 2015, which uses a kind of biographical approach to revolutionaries in different countries in the Atlantic world. It's very accessible. My students have really enjoyed it. And I could go on, but I
Well, I can tell you that the McPhee and Popkin books sound very familiar to me. And the reason is, I'm now remembering, is when I wanted to refresh my French Revolution reading list, I must have emailed you a couple of years ago and asked for suggestions on French Revolution books. And you suggested both of them and I read them and they're both great. So that's those are good suggestions. And I'll definitely check out Revolutionaries Without Borders, especially as I've tried to make my, I've actually started making my French Revolution unit a combined French and Haitian Revolution unit and really integrating the two, which I think has been really, really powerful. I don't do any Haitian Revolution role play, but I bring some outside sources in as we're doing the French Revolution. So having that kind of global Atlantic look is great.
There could be some interesting role playing if you compare Toussaint Louverture in Saint-Domingue or Haiti with certain figures in French history. And I think there are a lot of people now who are working on questions of race in the French Revolution.
Yeah.
And as I've taught the topic, I've incorporated more and more of the Caribbean into my French Revolution. And if we're going to put things into a sort of world history context, we kind of have to do that.
Right. Yeah. Well, David, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
You're welcome. It was fun for me.
Thank you to my guest and also to Colin McGrath for the beautiful background music. You can check out all of Colin's music, including his amazing album Window Seat on Spotify. You can also take a look at my books, upcoming picture books, materials for teachers, and writings on authentic assessment and other topics in social studies like role plays and mock trials at davidsharon.com. Thanks for joining me today. Hope you come on back.